are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, November 20th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor of Political Science from Indiana University, Bernard Fraga, on the turnout gap. Race, ethnicity, and political inequality in a diversified America. Also on the program today, Ivanka Trump has an email problem. Lock her up. And meanwhile, her dad to give written answers to Robert Mueller this week. Which means Black Friday is really going to be Black Friday. And not unlike Ohio and North Carolina, Wisconsin Dems get more votes than they do state lawmaker seats. Meanwhile, Obama-appointed federal judge halts Trump's asylum ban. And get this, troops. The troops are heading home. They are leaving the war zone that is the U.S.-Mexican border. I don't want to freak people out, but this is happening just as the caravan begins to reach our shores, so to speak. Meanwhile, the Trump administration have discussed sharing census info with law enforcement. And the Proud Boys, congratulations, are now classified by the FBI as an extremist group with white nationalist ties. And pretend Attorney General Matt Whitaker to be sued by the Senate Democrats. Meanwhile, of course, two mass shootings yesterday, killing 10. And lastly, chain CPI returns. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, on today's program. Just a couple of housekeeping notes up front. I am catching a cold. Perfectly timed so that I can not feel well when I am spending time with my family, which cuts a lot of different ways. And I don't think I need to get more explicit than that. But today may be a little bit short, so I can go home and nap. We will do our best. Usually what happens is I feel miserable at the beginning of the show. And then by the end of the show, it's typically I can't stop talking.
It's the adrenaline.
Yeah, it's the adrenaline. I'm game day. That's basically what it comes down to.
It's like flu Michael game. Jordan.
Yeah. I was just going to say flu game.
It's very much like Michael
flu
Jordan.
Flu game.
Speaking of Michael Jordan will not be a guest at our live show January 13th at the Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. It's at 2:30. It is an 18 and over. And tickets are only $15 because we want everyone to be able to attend. This is not one of those highfalutin shows where it costs you all sorts of money. This is a show for the people. And it's at 2:30 on a Sunday. Don't know if we're going to have guests, but we have definitely crossed off the list Michael Jordan.
I asked him and he said no because Republicans listen to podcasts too.
Yep, that's what he said. So, but you can get your tickets now by going to, you can go to majority.fm. We have a link. We are part of the Brooklyn Podfest. We will also put, of course, a link in the description, YouTube, and in the podcast description. Get your tickets now, folks. Do not dilly-dally, because they will sell out rather quickly.
They make a perfect holiday gift for your politically inclined loved ones.
Indeed. Indeed. So we're going to have a lot of fun there. Don't know, again, what we're going to do about guests or anything like that, but it's going to be fun. And don't forget, this show relies on its support of its members. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. It is the way that we create this show is because of our members. And we do the first 45 minutes to an hour free. And then we give a bonus to our members. A lot of extra time, a lot of fun time. You can hear, we get up close and personal after, during the fun half. Folks, have you ever had trouble finding the perfect present for someone? I'm looking at both of you guys. I don't even think you guys, this is slam dunk for both of you, for your folks. You can show your appreciation for anyone on your list by treating them to a gift from Mrs. Fields. Now, sometimes when we do stuff like this, when we do ads, we get the product sent to us. I did not know, some miscommunication, I did not know that we were doing an ad for Mrs. Fields. And that box came yesterday. Was it yesterday or Friday? I can't remember. And I was like, this is very nice. I was actually like genuine. Like I went through the experience of getting the gift. And then I have a problem with cookies and I ate too much of the gift. But it's nice. It's a nice, the cookies and the brownies were delicious and it makes you feel good. You get gifts. It's a nice thing. Mrs. Fields has made delicious treats for over 40 years, from their signature chocolate chip cookies to handcrafted frosted favorites and melt in your mouth brownies. Oh boy. Mrs. Fields' gourmet gift tins and baskets make the perfect present to surprise and delight anyone on your list. At Mrs. Fields, their cookies and sweets are baked daily. They always arrive fresh and flavorful. It's true. Ordering is easy. They can ship to you your gift anywhere in the U.S. Plus, you can add a personal touch with a custom message, company logo, or family photo. Oh, that would be good. Mrs. Fields even offers a 100% customer satisfaction guarantee. This year, send a fresh baked gift. No one can resist. I love those cookies. I'm bringing the wreaths home for the kids. They got the frosted ones. And then you guys can fight over it because I can't have them around the office anymore. I have a real problem. Right now, get 20% off your order when you go to MrsFields.com. Enter promo code MAJORITY. That's 20% off any gifts at MrsFields.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Mrs. Fields, FIELDS. .com. Promo code MAJORITY. Check out. We'll put that obviously in the podcast description and below the YouTube. Also, folks, this is one of my top, the other day we were talking about like top products that we do ads for. This is on that list. Life is too short for bad Wi-Fi. I have actually pushed Eero on several people in my life. Thankfully, the Eero home Wi-Fi system brings you a fast, reliable connection in every room in the house, not to mention the second generation Eero and Eero Beacon allow you to build a Wi-Fi system that's perfectly tailored to your home more than ever before. When you add Eero Plus, you get total network protection with the ability to block malicious and unwanted content across your entire network. By checking the sites you visit against the database of millions of known threats, Eero Plus prevents you from accidentally visiting malicious sites without slowing anything down. Eero Plus automatically tags sites that contain violent, illegal, or adult content, so you can choose what your kids can and cannot visit right from the Eero app. I'll tell you what this would be great for. It just occurs to me, like, put it in my parents' house so I don't have to worry about them getting into, like, a phishing situation. You can also get rid of annoying ads and pop-ups on all your devices. Ad blocking improves load times for heavy ad sites so you can browse and stream faster than ever before. In my household, I think I mentioned this the other day. Oh, I told Michael to say this. Did he say it? I used to have a problem. I would go to the bathroom and I would pick up my neighbor's Wi-Fi more than my own.
To help with connectivity.
And it was incredibly frustrating. With Eero, you basically put an extender, or you're creating a mesh. So we have one in the kids' bedroom, one in the hallway, one in the living room. And I have total coverage everywhere in the house. It's never an issue. But the other, and it was super easy to set up. I mean, super easy. Much easier than a traditional Wi-Fi router. You just get the app. It tells you exactly what to do. If one of them gets unplugged by mistake, I see it on the app. And I control when Mila's Wi-Fi turns off. And on top of that, can I not only control when the Wi-Fi turns off for her, I can do specific things. So it's like your phone doesn't work, but your computer does, so you can do your homework. No, I got full control. Last night she was complaining dramatically about it. Never think about Wi-Fi again. Get $100 off the Eero base unit and two beacons package and a year of Eero Plus. Just visit Eero, Eero.com/majority. Enter the code majority at checkout. That's Eero, Eero.com/majority and code majority at checkout. So yesterday we were talking about the attempts to unseat Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the Democrats in the House, and ultimately she's vying for Speaker of the House. And I was telling you my reasons why I would like to see her go, or at the very least, the problems I have had with what she has announced, or even maybe not even trumpeted about her tenure as Speaker of the House. And that was specifically the PAYGO provisions, where any new programs must be paid for. You cannot deficit spend. And a House rule that said you need a supermajority to raise taxes on anybody but the top 20%. And the combination of those two things, in my mind, makes it almost impossible to pursue any progressive, bold progressive agenda. And it gives congressmen and women an out as to why they couldn't pursue it, because there's no way to raise revenue, and we have to raise revenue because of the PAYGO rules. And we can't raise the revenue because we can only tax the top 20%. And this tax may burden, you know, people in the top 40% or whatever it is. Now, with that said, we mentioned the 16 signatories of a letter. We thought it was going to be 17 yesterday, and I think it's relevant and significant that it's only 16. Because 16 essentially is the number of people who can vote against Pelosi, and she can still win by one. We don't know exactly how many Democratic seats there are going to be. I suspect we're going to pick up one or two more. But as it stands now, 16 plus the 218 that you need puts it at 234 Democrats in the House. And I think that's about where we are right now. But the reason why, and I've been saying this for months, The hesitation about getting rid of Pelosi is that someone's got to be there. And no one has stepped up on the left to take that position. And there's not clear that anybody on the left could win that position. Or I should say, to the left of Pelosi, at least presumably. And AOC was on Chris Hayes last night, and this is how she put it, and I think it's spot on.
So one of the sort of big issues right now is this leadership fight. Mm-hmm. So there are 16 House Democrats who signed a letter saying the time has come for new leadership, basically saying they won't vote for Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. If Ben McAdams wins in Utah, that's they're one vote short of blocking her. Mm-hmm. Where are you and how do you read this fight?
Well, for me, when I was reading this letter that was kind of a released today, my main concern was that there is no vision, there is no common value, there is no goal that is really articulated in this letter aside from we need to change. And for me, what that says is, you know, I do think that we got sent to Congress on a mandate to change how government works, to change what government even looks like, but if we are not on the same page about changing the systems and the values and how we're going to adapt as a party for the future, then what is the point of just changing our party leadership just for the sake of it?
What I'm hearing from you is that you don't feel like there's an ideological or substantive sort of agenda-driven core of this objection.
No, I mean, if anything, I think that what it does is that it creates a window where we could potentially get more conservative leadership. And when you actually look at the signatories, it is not necessarily reflective of the diversity of the party. We, you know, after we have about 16 signatories, 14 of them are male. There are very few people of color in the caucus. There's very few ideological diversity.
Yeah.
It's not like there are progressives that are signing on. It's not like you have a broad-based coalition. So I find it, I'm not totally bought into the concept.
All right. I mean, that is what a smart leftist sounds like. Where she realizes this is what the playing field looks like. And so I can go out and pretend the playing field looks like something else or completely ignore what the playing field looks like and do something that's just basically arguably self-satisfying but gets us nowhere in terms of an agenda. The fact of the matter is, I think to a person, the people who have signed that letter are to the right of Nancy Pelosi. And, I mean, I'm looking at the letter. I don't think so.
Is this the sort of thing where they were all hoping that the Dems would perform worse in the midterms and this would actually make more sense from their end? Or what are they thinking?
No, the reason why, that's not a coincidence. Because they're in a district where they had to separate themselves from Nancy Pelosi because Nancy Pelosi, from an electoral standpoint, is, I think toxic is too strong of a word, but she polls very poorly in these districts. Probably polls not so great in a lot of districts, but apparently not so badly that it's going to bring you down if you put yourself at arm's length. So these 16 people, they are signing this letter because they want to run again in 2 years and they don't want to be associated with Pelosi. That's all well and good. And their opponent's going to say, my opponent says he doesn't like Nancy Pelosi, voted with her 85% of the time. And they're going to have to overcome that. But at least they're going to say, like, look, I signed a letter on day one. I'm against Nancy Pelosi. That's how that's going to go down. So that explains their motivation. But if you want a more, if the idea is that we want Nancy Pelosi out because she has a tin ear to where the country is moving in terms of moving to the left, electing someone who is to the right of her is not going to help you. However, saying to her, you know, we'll bring you the votes. We don't have a candidate that we want, but we will bring you the votes. Instead of abstaining, because you need our votes, as long as you start to basically take a couple of people that we sign off on, put them under your tutelage, train them to be the leader after or in the leadership after you go, which you've said you're transitioning out of probably within the next 2 years. That's what's happening. And so, but she put that very savvy. It's unbelievable to me how savvy she is. She doesn't even start off by saying they're ideologically to the right because she doesn't want to alienate anybody in the Democratic caucus. Why bother? It's the third or fourth, sort of where she gets like, they're not necessarily that progressive. Everybody knows. It's just that she's not throwing anybody under the bus unless there's value. Because this is not a performance. We're not watching a play. This is about someone who's trying to build power in an institution and doing it in various ways. I mean, I feel like I am defensive about this because I can't help but think there's going to be some morons out there who feel betrayed or think that, like, oh my God, this is why the Democrat, you know, there's a lot of dumbness around. And so this is one, both to praise her and to answer those dumb critics before they start to talk about it. And they probably already have. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Bernard Fraga about the turnout gap, race, ethnicity, and political inequality in a diversifying America. We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor of Political Science at Indiana University, Bernard Fraga, on his book, The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. Welcome to the program, Bernard.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's just start with the central premise. There is a turnout gap between whom?
So what I identify is the gap in the rate of participation between whites and, we could say, minority Americans. So even after accounting for citizenship, age, socioeconomic factors, we still see big disparities in the rate of turnout for minorities, African Americans, Latinos, Asians, versus white or Caucasian Americans.
Okay, and what would you say is the biggest myth about what causes that that gap, and maybe you've already stated at least one of those myths, right? Or that maybe it has something to do with like the median age of people of color in this country, or the economic status of people of color in this country. But those are not factors.
So I'm going to take that. I think that you're right. A lot of people think about citizenship or age or socioeconomics as big factors. But now I want to take that in another direction a little bit, which is that I think the biggest myth is that minorities don't vote because they don't want to, because it's something about not being interested in politics or a lack of knowledge about politics. In fact, when you look at the data, there is interest in politics. It's just a lack of mobilization and a lack of engagement by candidates and parties.
So, all right. So what does that mean? Lack of mobilization, lack of engagement. And give us an example of that. I mean, how do we know that is in the wild, as it were?
Sure. So when we look at surveys of rates of contact or mobilization of racial and ethnic minority groups, especially African Americans and Latinos, one of the things we see is that even after accounting for, the fact that Black voters tend to be heavily Democratic, that means Democrats should try and mobilize them, rates of contact are still lower than what we would expect, lower than they are for whites. And the same story goes for Latinos. Despite Latinos being this growing electorate and the candidates talking a lot about trying to mobilize Latino voters. When you look at the data, Latinos say they're not contacted by campaigns, they're not talked to, and most especially, their issues are not being addressed by the two major parties.
Okay, so all right, let's just start with the lack of contact and mobilization. I mean, essentially what that comes down to is they're just not asked in the same way, essentially, to vote.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that what you see is in most jurisdictions, so in most states or in most congressional districts, parties and candidates running for office understand that white voters are decisive, that if they want to win, they have to mobilize, turn out, talk about the issues that pertain to white Americans. That's just the demographic reality, even as we become a more diverse country. So when it comes to those campaign strategies, even the GOTV on Election Day, a lot of it is focused on trying to turn out white voters. Perhaps it should be because of the numbers, but that's going to mean lower turnout for minority groups.
Well, I want to put a pin in that and ask you in a bit if that is necessarily the case. Like, if it's necessarily the case that it has to mean that. But let's wait till we get there. I mean, so give us just a sense of how much of a gap exists.
Sure. So I use voter file data in my analyses. Surveys have some issues about people overreporting whether they vote and sampling issues, but using voter file data, provided by a voter file vendor, what we see is that the gap in turnout in, for example, the 2016 election between white turnout and black turnout was on the order of maybe 15 percentage points. That means the black rate of voter turnout was 15 percentage points lower than white turnout. And in midterm elections, we see a pretty similar gap in recent years. Now, this year, it might be a little bit better, but that's a big difference. For Latinos, we're talking on the order of 25 to 30 percentage points difference in the rate of voter turnout. So that's after accounting for citizenship and then at age. And for Asian Americans, again, around 25 to 30 percentage point difference in the rate of voter turnout.
Wow.
These are big differences, right? I mean, these are differences that might, help us understand some of the election results we've seen recently.
And now 2016, where did 2016 fit in there versus, let's say, 2012 or 2008?
So we saw a big drop off in black voter turnout in 2016 versus 2008 or 2012. The gap between white and black turnout almost doubled in 2016 versus 2012. The census, reports that black turnout was, nearly a record high in 2012. I find that black turnout was substantially higher in 2012 versus other years. But 2016 was a low year for black voter turnout, especially Latino turnout. Was about average, maybe a little bit higher than it had been in the past. But the big story is that black-white turnout gap increasing in 2016.
Okay, so I think it's fairly obvious to folks in this audience why that would be a bad thing for the fortunes of Democrats. I mean, the Republican Party is something like, and you would probably know this figure better than I, but somewhere around the lines of 95% white, right? I don't think that's hyperbole. I mean, I think that's pretty close in terms of its voters overall. And so, and Democrats traditionally lose the white vote, at least in terms of presidential elections. And so they need people of color. There's no dispute there. So, I mean, what happened? The obvious answer on some level, it seems to me, about 2012 to 2016 is simply that Barack Obama was black, and that drove people to the polls. Or was there or is it because there is just a better sense of how to approach a constituency that is overlooked by somebody else? I mean, what accounts for that?
So two things. Number one, you're absolutely right that the Republican Party is heavily white. It's not quite 95%. It's around 90%. But I mean, that's okay. That's very high. And, you know, and the Democratic Party, this is the other part of the story. The Democratic Party is also heavily white. And I think we don't realize that. But if you look at the data, about 57, maybe 60% of the Democratic Party's white voters in terms of the base of support that they can depend on consistently in elections. So both parties have high incentives to cater to white voters. Now, with that in mind, 2012 versus 2016, the drop-off, was it because of Obama? I think in many ways it was because you didn't have a candidate like Barack Obama at the top of the ticket. But it's not just because he was African-American. Because Obama in 2008 and 2012 realized that in order to win, in order to shore up maybe flagging support among some white voters who might be reluctant to vote for an African-American, he was going to have to do the work on the ground to mobilize not just African-Americans, but Latino voters, and not just minority voters, but young voters, including young whites. So really the story in 12 versus 16 was a shift in the understanding of what it was going to take to win for a Democratic candidate. I don't think it's hyperbole to say that people thought that Hillary Clinton had this in the bag, especially with an opponent like Donald Trump. She thought that she was going to be able to depend on high turnout from Latinos just because they'd reject Trump, or African-Americans because Obama had been president. Instead, it needed on the groundwork, especially in those blue wall states, and maybe that's what didn't happen.
I mean, because, you know, it's interesting. We had we spoke to John Sides last week, who has with a couple others written a book about the racial attitudes that changed over the course of the elections, and one of the aspects of that book that we discussed was that Hillary Clinton was, in many respects, at least from a campaigning style, right? We're separating now, and this is important for people to understand. We're separating the rhetoric from the actual mechanisms of getting people to the polls. But that her campaign was more racial in some respects than Obama's, at least in terms of what issues it addressed. And so, if I hear you correctly, that's all well and good, but that doesn't get people to the polls.
I think that's true. It doesn't get people to the polls. And I think you're absolutely right. As you know, as Professor Sides mentioned, and in his book, which is excellent, by the way, you know, they talk about this increased racialization of politics. But it's important to note that, you know, goes the other way, too, in terms of mobilization. So before the election, even in the summer, the notion was that for Trump to win, he would have to mobilize and get support from white voters to a level that seemed implausible. And that's exactly what he did. And he did it through that racialized campaign environment, through talking about, you know, the things that he said, building a wall, other things. You know, so to me, the point is, it's not just that Clinton was talking about racial issues maybe more than we had seen in the past and was running a racialized campaign in that environment. It's that Trump was taking advantage of that and using it to mobilize his white base.
So wait, so. Is it the case? I mean, was his ground game that good? In other words, like if Trump is out there and able to get people to the polls, you know, this sort of white contingency that otherwise, you know, showed up more than people anticipated, he was able to motivate them, it seems to me, with rhetoric, right? Mm-hmm. In a way mm-hmm. that I think. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, you're suggesting doesn't work for the Democrats in the same way.
So I think that it does work for, I think that it can work similarly across groups. And here's a story that I would tell, right? So mobilization is one part of the story, and mobilization is not just a, hey, you should turn out to vote, although that's important. It's also talking about the issues of importance to different communities. It's also being present outside of election time. It's also, frankly, the presence of the candidate being able to, I guess, be perceived at least as a legitimate representative of a community. And I think when you think about mobilization in a broader sense like that, you can see that Trump's rhetoric was mobilizing beyond just the ground game. It was mobilizing because it gave a very, I would say, easy narrative to some voters, especially white voters, who you know, felt like they were left behind, but frankly, in a racialized environment, felt like whites were losing their dominance in politics. So it wasn't so much the ground game for Trump as his rhetoric, although the ground game was also an important component. I think that we overstated how poor his ground game was relative to Hillary Clinton.
And I guess to a certain extent, one could argue that Trump's Trump was considered more authentically quasi-racist and xenophobic and misogynist than maybe Clinton was considered authentic in terms of what material benefits she could provide to communities of color.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think especially in the wake of things like, you know, Black Lives Matter, a kind of lukewarm embrace of that movement, you know, in order to protect her support from some whites, you know, she maybe made that calculation, versus Trump, who was able to say things that a lot of voters said, you know, no one had ever said to them before, and they liked what they heard. Not all whites, of course, but, you know, a majority. And that was mobilizing for that segment of the electorate.
So that there's a bit of a high wire act, it seems to me, for the Democrats. I mean, even with, you know, 90% dealing with a 90% homogenous electorate. Homogenous may be too strong of a word, but sharing certain attributes and experiences and, you know, the way that they face the world seems to me to be easier than dealing with one that about 60% and then the 40% is other, because let's circle back to that question. If you're addressing the concerns of white people, can you also address the concerns of people of color? And let's talk about, you know, sort of, well, let's start with that question. I mean, is there, you know, how much of a high wire act is that? Does it have to be? And then let's talk about maybe the differences between, black folk and Latino and Asian communities. But let's just start with that question of walking that high wire.
So I think it's challenging. Don't get me wrong. I think that it's difficult to cater to different constituencies. And although, it's a relatively recent phenomenon to think of white voters as a voting bloc, we usually tend to break it down into, you know, white women, suburban, rural, college educated versus not. I think that the message that Trump had in 2016 resonated with a segment of the white electorate that is beginning to perceive of itself as a bloc, as a kind of a white bloc of voters. But let's take it back for a second and think about our most recent election, 2018. So you saw candidates like Stacey Abrams, African-American minority leader in, you know, in the Georgia House, able to be there and perform, frankly, better than any Democrat had in a good amount of time in Georgia.
They're putting the vote tallies up there, and she blew away any Democrat who has run, you know, in over like a, well, I mean, you have an increased population, but in the past 10 years, like blew them away in terms of number of votes.
Exactly. And most of those candidates were white. They were running in Georgia statewide. They thought they'd had a chance. And, you know, Stacey Abrams didn't shy away from discussing issues of importance to the African-American community. She didn't hide from that. And yet she did really well. So to me, I think the story there, and even Andrew Gillum, who maybe underperformed a little bit in Florida, but did about just as well as, you know, Nelson did, even though he wasn't talking about African-American issues as much. You know, I think it shows you that there are opportunities here to build a broad coalition and really speak to issues maybe in this highly racialized environment of importance to at least white Democrats, in addition to Democrats of color, African-American and Latino Democrats. So, yes, it's a challenge, but I think that we have seen the opportunities and the possibilities that exist in building a broad coalition, at least across the racial spectrum on the Democratic side.
Not to overly reference a different book in the context of it, but in that book, Identity Crisis, one of the things that I found interesting was that it seems that voters can, different identities they have can be activated at different times, right? Mm-hmm. And so It really has to do with the way that you cut your message cuts across them. I mean, I guess, you know, the metaphor I would use is like, you know, that onions can taste different depending on how you slice them as to whether or not they caramelize or something like that. Maybe I'm making that up about, but as we slice the electorate in different ways, people get activated in different ways. Trump found a way of slicing the white electorate that was successful to him, activating racism and xenophobia and misogyny and stitching together a wonderful coalition of people that way. And I guess Obama did as well in respects that he was able to speak to people of color's concerns, but also to motivate white voters in the same way. I mean, do you have a sense of like what that was? I mean, what that message was that encaptured all those people? Was it simply the idea in some respects of what having the first African-American president would represent?
So I think, and I like your metaphor, the idea of an onion, you know, it tastes different depending on the way you cut it or the way you cook it. I will say this, you know, both parties are coalitions of different groups. You know, for a candidate to win, especially something like the presidency, it's going to take bringing together groups of people who have different interests and who might want different things out of politics. That's the truth. And Trump did it too, right? 90% of Republicans voted for Trump, whether they were never Trumpers at any point in time or not. A lot of them didn't support him in the primary, and they still turned out to vote for him. So the bottom line is both parties are coalitions like that. What I would emphasize is that for Democrats, and thinking about the 2016 election, remember, Clinton won the popular vote, as we all know. Clinton had a coalition that was viable. It just wasn't viable barely in a few states that just made it. You know, our discussion would be completely different if Clinton had won the Electoral College and, you know, won the popular vote by the margin she did. It would be, this is the end of Trumpism, the Republican coalition is a failure, etc. So I don't want to put too much into
right.
Clinton and her campaign as a, you know, failing to really connect the groups that Obama was able to connect. She did, just not in a few places. And those few places where she wasn't able to do it have very white electorates. Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Iowa. Those are the places where Trump and the Republican Party understood that white voters are going to be decisive in election outcomes. And to me, when you combine that with low minority turnout, especially in those places, that's why you see the election results that you do. So I don't think it's so much an issue of the messaging or the coalition that was brought forth, Clinton versus Obama versus Sanders versus whoever else. It was just fell short by a little bit in a few states because, again, white voters dominate election outcomes, and that's what drives the patterns we see.
But if, if we saw better mobilization in a place like Wisconsin or Michigan, I mean, those numbers in particular, right? Those feel yeah. like that to me feels like a one or two decent organizers in those states. And it's a different outcome, right? I mean, that like it seems to me that that is it's not hard. I mean, obviously, in retrospect, but it's not hard to imagine a different outcome in those places. I mean, so what is it? I mean, is it really just a matter of saying like, hey, we just need to raise enough money to have an extra 10 to 15% of resources to go and knock on doors in black communities, in Latino communities, in Asian American communities, or we need some other mechanism in which we are dedicating to getting out the vote there?
So I think the resources would help. Clearly, that's part of the puzzle. We don't have the voter file data yet, but the evidence suggests that Latino turnout might have gone up a little bit in 2018, certainly higher than it was in 2014, which was an especially low year for Latino voter turnout. And there were some investments from within the Democratic Party and outside of the Democratic Party to boost Latino turnout. So resources definitely help. But I will say there's a deeper problem there, which is that in states like Michigan, Wisconsin, those states, African-American turnout was already very low in 2012 and 2008. So it got even lower in 2016, but it's a long-standing disparity in voter turnout between whites and African-Americans that's going to take more than just resources. It's going to take candidates, the party, really talking about and addressing the issues of concern to these communities. And, you know, the way that I talk about in my book is that the incentives are simply not aligned with candidates or parties doing that. In Wisconsin or in Michigan, Democrats, if they want to win, have to get substantial white support. There just aren't enough minority voters. So, of course, they're going to focus their efforts on, you know, the white electorate there. So the fear is that there's a trade-off being made between mobilizing and speaking about the issues of concern to people of color versus making sure you can maintain just enough white voters to be viable in electorate. And I think the disparities in turnout are a product of that trade-off being made.
But what is it that, is that trade-off just a question of finite resources, or is it a question of, as you get more in touch with the concerns of people of color, you risk putting off white people because they go like, hey, wait a second, they're going to get our stuff.
Well, I mean, that's a tricky thing. I think that it's very contextually dependent. I think that what we saw in 2018 in a few states like Georgia is that you can have that balance. But then, you know, Stacey Abrams still lost, right? More resources would help, but there were a lot of resources invested in Georgia, especially through, you know, groups like Black Voters Matter, other non-party, nonpartisan groups invested in mobilizing African Americans. And again, turnout was up, but, you know, it might not be enough. And it might not be enough in states like Wisconsin and Michigan, you know, without the kind of massive investment that you see in a place like Georgia, because, you know, Georgia is about a 30% African-American state. Michigan and Wisconsin are not 30% African-American. So I think it has to do also with the non-party actors, where resources are not going to create community organizations statewide in a place like Michigan or Wisconsin in the way they have in Georgia. So to me, it's really a tricky situation, but one that the Democrats need to think really deeply about if they want to be able to leverage demographic change and really say we can build a robust, sustaining coalition with a more diverse electorate.
Let's touch on, I mean, you say vote suppression does not explain the turnout gap. And mm-hmm. it must explain some, right? Or no? And you know, we talk about Stacey Abrams. There is certainly, she believes this, and it I think it's a fairly compelling case, right? I mean, the amount of voter suppression in Georgia, and maybe it's best to assess it, but like white versus black, right? Like, I mean, it's hard to say what kind of resources, you know, like I know there's a dynamic where sometimes suppression itself can drive turnout because it motivates people and it focuses resources. But the bottom line is surely like the white turnout in Georgia does not need to do, is not a bank shot. You don't need to like, it just, you, it, it, the functioning of white turnout in Georgia versus African-American turnout in Georgia, it seems to me, is a lot smoother machine. And this, you know, particularly this cycle when you had the candidate in charge of the voting rolls, essentially.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, vote suppression, when I talk about this in the book, you know, I try and be careful in the way I discuss it, because we know, you know, two things for sure. Number one is that vote suppression, especially things like voter identification laws or cuts to early voting, disproportionately impact minority voters. We know that, you know, Black and Latino voters are the ones, you know, who are less likely to have qualifying forms of identification. They're more mobile, so things like voter purges are going to affect them more. They're more likely, especially African Americans, to use early voting than whites. So that's true. Second thing that's true is that these laws are passed in places where there's an incentive to demobilize minority voters. And this is important. Georgia was one of the first states to pass a voter identification law way back in 2006, although it wasn't implemented until later. That's because there's a large pool of African-American voters with relatively high turnout relative to other states in the country. So the point is that these laws are passed in places where minority turnout, especially black turnout, is already very high, because you don't need to suppress in states where there's very few minority voters, where turnout's very low.
Right.
The other Republicans you need to suppress in places where turnout's already high. So when we sit there and try and judge these laws and say, do they decrease turnout? Do they explain the turnout gap? I say, well, not really, because turnout is highest in the places where there's a big incentive to pass these laws. So they occur in places where turnout's already high for minority groups. Now, with those two facts in mind, you know, Georgia was a very close race. Same in Florida. We can talk about the ballot design in Broward County in Florida and this kind of thing, right? In a close election, these small changes that are induced by vote suppression, order of 1 to 2 percentage points, let's say, are enough to be decisive. So it can certainly be the case that vote suppression doesn't explain these large 10 to 15 to 20 percentage point differences in who votes, but can still be the margin of victory for a candidate in a very close election. And that's why these laws, which again are to prevent fraud, which doesn't exist, we can't measure it, at least not in ways that could be prevented by voter ID laws or restrictions on early voting. You know, given that we don't have any evidence on that, we instead should question these laws and say, why do we need them when we already have very low voter turnout, especially for minority groups in most parts of the country?
So vote suppression is almost like a reverse indicator of the problem that you see. Okay, so getting back to that problem, what accounts for the disparity in the voter gap? Like you said, 15% voter gap, and I guess that's an average, right? And in those areas where we see the institutional vote suppression, I would imagine that gap starts off lower. And that's why you need voter suppression from the perspective of the people on the wrong side of those votes. And I imagine in some states it's higher than 15%. But why is Latino the gap 25 or 30% relative to white people? Why is Asian Americans 25-30%? Why? What accounts for that? Do you have any sense?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think that circles back to some of the discussions we had at the beginning of our conversation, right? So mobilization and talking about issues, or what I'd call even empowerment, right? Those are the mechanisms that produce voter turnout. People, you know, people aren't born voters. They have to become voters. Their issues get talked about. They care about politics. They pay attention. And they're asked to vote. And that's what makes someone a voter. That doesn't happen to the same extent in minority communities. So in the book, I try and figure out, well, what predicts those differences in turnout? Why in some states do we see a smaller gap and in other states it's a much wider gap? Why do we see a larger gap for some groups than others? And the explanation I have is that it's about the incentives and the incentive structure we have in our current electoral system, right? All you need is 50% to win. And the bottom line is, in every single state, except for Hawaii, in every state, white voters dominate election outcomes. They're the largest group, the plurality group, in every single state in the country, aside from Hawaii. So everywhere in the country, if you're running for office, you're saying the most important block of voters that I need to pay attention to think about, to address issues on behalf of, is the white electorate. And in places where that changes, like in majority-minority congressional districts, or in a few places where the minority population is a little larger, like in the Deep South, that's where we see a reversal of the turnout gap. That's where we see gains in minority turnout relative to white voter turnout. That's where the disparities are smaller. So to me, the mechanisms are mobilization and empowerment, but the cause of that is the incentive structure. The incentives are aligned such that in most places and most of the time, candidates and campaigns should be trying to mobilize and turn out white voters just because of the population differences.
All right. So if I hear you, we can't necessarily list off a list of specific things, but just that politicians behave in a certain way where they go fishing where the fish are, essentially.
Yeah.
And when the fish are people of color, the turnout gap is much lower or non-existent. I mean, mm-hmm. do we have places where turnout by people of color in presumably majority-minority districts is higher than of white people?
Yes. So we have a complete reversal in that black turnout is higher than white turnout in many majority minority districts. And even for Latinos, in some of the border districts where turnout is low overall, Latino turnout is about equal to white voter turnout, because in those places, Latinos, again, you know, dominate election outcomes. And if you want to win, you have to mobilize and cater to Latino voters.
So what, I mean, so if I was to go in and I was go one of those communities, right, where people of color's turnout is greater, where the gap is, the turnout gap is reversed relative to what it is in a majority white district. Mm-hmm. And I was to study the politician, and see how they're talking, what issues they're talking about, what events they're going to, and write all that down. Would that be the key for me? I mean, then I got to take it back to, let's say, my majority white district and figure out how to integrate that or get the resources to emulate that and maintain what I would instinctually do to play to a majority white district. But is there something else societally that is going on that everyone has an awareness that the voting bloc that I am a part of is going to dictate this election? So in some ways, my vote is more important and more powerful.
Yeah, so I think you're right that it's a little implausible to think about it as, can we import what happens in majority minority districts, bring it to a majority white district or a majority white state, use those same tactics, yet still maintain the margins you're getting with white voters? That's difficult to do. But, you know, I will say that that's kind of similar to what we saw with some campaigns in 2018. I think that, you know, for example, Stacey Abrams, when talking to, just like you said, with identity and activating different identities at different times, Stacey Abrams could go into the black community and be seen as a legitimate representative, knowing how to talk about issues, right? That might be a lesson from majority minority districts that could then be imported to certain audiences at a statewide level. But yeah, I think that, you know, you're right that it's a difficult trade-off and something that we have to really think about. You know, is it even feasible, and should candidates be trying to make that trade-off, or are they better off, you know, with what's worked in the past, which is mobilizing white voters? I think that's absolutely right.
Is there another potential solution in that you try and slice up the electorate in an even different way, where you look more at economic class as a sort of a primary way of slicing up the electorate, in that way you cut across these differences so that you're speaking to two groups that in one district may seem disparate, but in this district you're creating a sense of your message is resonating with across, you know, ethnic or racial lines.
I think, you know, I think many candidates, especially in the Democratic Party, believe that that is the solution, that it's talking about kind of these cross-cutting issues. As an example, right now, you know, we're going to have a runoff election in Mississippi for the Senate. Mike Espy, who's African-American, is running there, the Democrat. And, you know, he says his target is to get high minority turnout, that is high African-American turnout, and about a quarter of white voters. 25% is his goal. And, you know, despite his opponent making some statements that many are perceiving as very racially charged, including saying his Republican opponent said she would, you know, love to be front row for a public hanging, which in the South has a very specific connotation. SB is not talking about that. He's talking about healthcare. He's talking about jobs and education. And I think that that's a strategy the Democrats have taken for a long time. So it's not so much the issues and the rhetoric, where I agree that that's a necessary condition, is talking about issues that are cross-cutting, that can build other coalitions. It's really about the, you know, are candidates going to black churches and saying, let me talk about the issues, let me hear what your concerns are. Are they going into urban communities that are heavily minority and saying, what are your concerns, what do you want government to be doing? right? I think that the kind of, if we broadly conceive of a left, a broad kind of left platform, actually plays very well in many minority communities, but is seen as alienating white voters. So it's very strange in that many of the policy items that are seen as, and this is because of racialization and many other factors, many of the policy items that are seen as catering to a kind of white left-wing voter base actually play very well in diverse African-American Latino communities. So, you know, the rhetoric might not have to change. It might just be delivering the message or the way that you deliver the message that has to change. But I think the agenda, and again, the agenda of the kind of more center to center left wing of the Democratic Party is broadly favored by minority communities on issues like immigration, criminal justice, even it's just getting that message out there and really speaking to the community on the community's own ground and in the manner that the community wants to hear.
Is that maybe what accounts on some level for the even greater gap in terms of Latino and Asian American voters, insofar as those communities may be less homogenous in some? I'm not suggesting that the Black community is particularly homogenous, but when we say Latino, we could be talking about people from 15 different national backgrounds with some fairly, with maybe even more unique cultures. Same with Asian Americans, right? I mean, does that account for anything?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the diversity within minority groups creates different challenges. I will say that the other part of the story is that African Americans and, you know, their relatively higher turnout compared to Latinos and Asians, part of that is also because of how critical they are to Democratic fortunes in the South, right? So even though in a state like Mississippi, which is only about 37% African American, there, you know, any Democrat has to get 90% of the Black vote, right? For Latinos, you know, in a state like Texas, Latinos are, you know, about 30% of the electorate, but they're nowhere near as Democratic as African Americans are in Texas or elsewhere. You know, more like maybe 70-30 or even more Republican than that even. 30-35% voting Republican. That means the Democrats look at Latino voters and say, well, you know, that's not really as reliable a vote as if they were African American. So it's going to take even more Latino voters for them to say the incentives are aligned with mobilization. So I think it's not just the kind of ethnic or national origin diversity in the Latino and Asian American community. It's also the political diversity, the partisan kind of heterogeneity in those communities means that the population has to be even larger for candidates to see a viable path forward by investing significant resources in mobilizing those communities.
So when you go in and mobilize the African American community, your yield is higher necessarily.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
In 20 years from now, in 30 years from now, is this conversation largely moot because you're going to see more and more ethnic diversity and more people of color relative to white populations, and then the turnout gaps, you know, in 45 years, my kid's going to be having interviewing your kid, and they're going to be saying, like, what are we going to do about this white turnout gap? It seems to be pretty big. I mean, is that what's going to happen?
Well, so two things on this. You know, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about, you know, it's part of the title, this diversification of America. And I will note that 15 to 20 years ago, that's what we said would happen right now, is that, you know, we're a majority minority nation, sleeping giant. Latino voters have awakened. Minority voters are pivotal. The Republican Party, unless they become more diverse and cater to minority voters, you know, it's basically a dead party. And, you know, up until the last election, you know, Republicans controlled all three branches of government. So I think that making projections about the future, especially given the racialization of our politics, all it would take is for white voters to shift just a little bit more into the Republican camp for us to see, you know, the same patterns we've seen in recent elections continue to manifest for a generation or more. So, I mean, it really depends on the nature of the coalitions and whether Republicans make further inroads with white voters. That said, I think you're right that as we become more diverse, if the party coalitions don't change significantly, then the incentives are going to be more and more aligned with, especially the Democrats, mobilizing minority voters. And I think in places like Florida and Georgia, 10 years ago, candidate would have said, or before Obama, let's say, someone would have said, you know, you can't run a black candidate in Georgia or Florida. There's no way they're going to win. And the increased diversity of those states, growing Latino population in both of those states, has made it so a, you know, Democrat of color maybe is more viable there than in the past. So I think you're going to see changes, but I think the magnitude of those changes means that this is not something the Democrats can just kind of wait and it'll happen naturally. It's going to take that investment and really saying, look, if the Democratic Party's coalition is going to be people of color, heavily people of color in the future, those investments have to start now, or else small gains by Republicans with white voters are going to pay off much more in the near term.
Bernard Fraga, the book is The Turnout Gap, Race, Ethnicity, and Political Inequality in a Diversifying America. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link at majority.fm.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Going to, try and take a lozenge during the break. Don't forget, you can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Check out TMBS. There were two of them last week. Whoa, is he not? He's not here tonight either, right? So
yeah, we're unlocking some stuff, and we got some premium content.
Wow. All right. Whatever. Nice.
Doing the TMLS. Tonight, maybe. No, we're not going to do that.
What is the TML?
The Matt Leck Show.
Oh, really? Oh, the cat's away. Tune into TMBS tonight and hear...
talking about the Pequot War.
the Antifada. They've got a couple out. Catch up on them this week at patreon.com/theantifada. And speaking of literary hangover, Matt...
Yep, we're talking about Catherine Meir Sedgwick. She also, I mentioned a little bit about how she had a ancestor who married into a Mohawk family. She also had a cousin who married into a Cherokee family to one of the signatories of the treaty that led to the Trail of Tears, who was later assassinated for signing it. So, small world back then.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, literally. All right. Take a quick break, head into the fun half. The number is 646-257-3920. I will endeavor to answer as many calls as possible today within the confines of my my health. See you in the fun half.